It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Love, grief, failure, loneliness. As you know, these are real aspects of life we just can't escape, and it's complicated, which is why some philosophical thinking may help us make new connections and think differently about life. Philosopher Kiran Setia has reflected on the human condition and the ways in which life is hard, especially in pandemic times. Join in on how philosophy has helped inform how you see living. 800-642-1234. Kiran Setia is a philosophy professor at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. New book is called Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. Kiran, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here again.
Well, people experience hardship in so many different forms and ways. And I had to laugh because you said in writing this book, you described it as, I'm thinking about the ways in which life is hard, an activity that has no end.
And that's true.
I just thought, oh my gosh, well, we're doomed. How can philosophy help us navigate all this pain and hardship?
Well, some of it is specific to particular hardships, but there are guiding ideas that really helped me. So maybe three are worth sharing. One is that I think we have to push back against online influencers who tell us, live your best life, find your bliss. And it's not just a fad. This kind of idea of focusing on the ideal goes back to Aristotle in ancient Greece, talking about eudaimonia as the ideal life, one free of suffering and human need. Mm-hmm. And that's just not a realistic goal to have in life. And the second key idea, I think, is that we have to distinguish feeling happy from living well. I mean, you could feel happy while being living a lie, living in a dream world, but we have to live in the world as it is, not the world as we wish it would be. And I would say the third key idea is that once you start thinking of your goal in life as to live well, try to live a good life, not just to feel happy, you realize that the lines between self-interest and justice or morality or concern for other people are actually very blurry. Part of living a good life, living in the way you should, is caring about other people and caring about society. And so I think, you know, in a way, I think self-help, philosophical self-help, should be a little less selfish.
That's interesting. I mean, you describe a good life as selective, limited, and fractional in practice. Can you pick that apart a little bit? How is it those things?
Well, Aristotle, again, has this idea that, you know, a good life is lacking in nothing. But actually, if you think about people in your life who are living as, you know, doing as well as you can do, you know, for me, there are like my old teacher, D.H. Meller, who died last year during the pandemic, or like heroes like Iris Murdoch, their lives are still extremely partial. No one is able to develop every kind of capacity for every kind of good thing in life. And that's okay. It's just, what we aim for and what we should aim for is a good enough life with enough good things in it to make our life satisfying, to be able to find meaning and find joy. The idea of missing out on nothing, having everything, is a sort of deception that striving for that is just going to lead us to disappointment and frustration.
Well, missing out on nothing. I mean, when you're scrolling through social media, you think that everyone is living in, you know, a life that is way different than your own reality. How do you differentiate that? And you know, especially in the pandemic.
Yeah, I think there's not just FOMO in the sense of, you know, missing out on the party tonight and thinking, you know, I wish I'd gone, or maybe there's a better party. There's this sort of existential FOMO where we're constantly confronted with these flattering portraits of other people's lives. I mean, the first thing to say is just to remember just how deceptive that is, to think about your own, if you're on social media, how distorted your own self-representation is, and to remember that everyone's is the same. But I mean, part of it is also that suffering is so often hidden. People, I think, should be willing to talk more often about the ways in which their life is hard. And one of the risks of not being open about how life is hard, about one's own adversities, is that it creates this sort of false ideals for other people and a kind of false sense of what life should be like. Whereas almost everyone has some kind of adversity they're dealing with and is trying to make life good enough despite that. They're trying to cope with adversity in the way they should and make something out of it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how philosophy can help us navigate the pain and suffering in life. Kiran Setia is a professor of philosophy at MIT. New book, Life is Hard. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kiran, you really put yourself into this book as you look at hardships, and you speak very openly about chronic pain. How has living with chronic pain affected your life and affected who you are?
Well, yeah, this one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to share my experience and to generate a little solidarity with other people, the many Americans who are dealing with some kind of chronic pain. Mine is one of the more embarrassing kinds, which is chronic pelvic pain, which started when I was 27. And it took a long time to get a, quote, diagnosis, although the diagnosis is chronic pelvic pain, which, you know, it is what it sounds like, and it explains really nothing. There's no reliable treatment. I think, you know, reflecting on the fact that this is not going away, I think one of the moments that really stays with me is at some point when I thought, no, this is something I'm going to have to live with. I remember sitting and looking across a room at other people and being filled with this kind of bitter envy, looking at them thinking, you don't know how good you have it being pain-free. It just, and then there was a kind of beat, and I realized I have no idea what's going on with those people any more than they have any idea that I'm sitting here in pain. And I think that kind of switch, that this sort of leveraging one's own sense of adversity into a recognition that everyone has their own kinds of adversity, even if it's not chronic pain, there are things they're going through that may be invisible to you. That, I think, is the lasting shift for me in my perspective on the world and on other people that really led me to write this book.
Something that stands out there in that moment when you said pain is lonely, not because it separates us from others, but because it separates us from ourselves. How does pain separate us from ourselves?
Well, I think that one of the key challenges of chronic pain is that if it was just a sort of series of moments of pain, you know, day of pain, it wouldn't be so bad. One of the ways in which it creates a problem is that you're constantly anxiously projecting into a future in which you'll never be free of it. And you lose touch with a sense of your own past bodily experience without it. So when you're in the midst of it, you feel like you have no real connection with your own enduring self. And that is something that I think makes it hard, and also something that you can reframe and really fight against.
Reframing disabilities or a serious illness that can drastically affect life, but you show that life can be just as meaningful or happy. You make that case. How can someone who faces a disability or a severe decline in health, how can they use philosophy to see that or endure that in and thrive?
Well, I mean, this can seem simplistic, but I think the insight that Aristotle is wrong to say that a good life is lacking in nothing is part of what's helpful here, recognizing that no one, even people who are living your sort of the best lives we can imagine, is doing everything. There's always limits to what they're able to access, what they're able to achieve, what they're able to do. And so life is incredibly rich. And so a disability, for instance, will cut you off from one thing. But so long as there are sufficient accommodations, it needn't cut you off from everything of value. And so I think that the real danger with disabilities comes when, say, your inability to get around without a wheelchair makes it hard to do anything else because you can't get a wheelchair, or there aren't ramps, or access to all kinds of other good things are taken away. But very often, you know, there are physical disabilities that are very pervasively damaging, but many, given suitable accommodations, leave so much in place that it's possible to live a good life in the way most of us does, that's partial and limited despite that. And that, in fact, is what the social science suggests, is that people with local disabilities like mobility problems or blindness or deafness, people dealing with those things actually bounce back surprisingly rapidly and are able to very often to find meaningful lives. And I think this is why. It's because provided you're not cut off from too much, that there's plenty of different ways to make a good life.
MIT philosopher Kiran Setia bringing us philosophical insights, roadmaps to life's hardships. The book is called Life is Hard. And Kieran opens up about his own experiences living with chronic pain. Join in on how philosophy has helped you get through difficult times or seeing life in a new way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to be in conversation with MIT philosophy professor Kieran Setia. His new book is about how philosophy can help us navigate and reflect on the adversities we are bound to encounter. Kieran, our guide to old age and loneliness, failure, grief, how to think about hope, another chapter. And it's challenges we encounter simply because we are human. Join in on when you leaned into philosophy and what you got out of it. 800-642-1234. The book is called Life is Hard, and Kieran Setia stays with us. So started a podcast in the pandemic, and I'm laughing because so many people did start podcasts in the pandemic. But what did you gain from producing this podcast?
Well, it was a cliche, exactly. I had the least original response to my own loneliness, but yeah, no, it was exactly prompted by the sense that my social network had shrunk. And you know, I was very lucky in that I live with my wife and kid, and it's not a difficult situation. Like I'm happy at home, so I didn't have much to complain about. But I nevertheless, the sense of losing contact with a wider world of people was really hard. And so one of the things I wanted to do was to just connect with other philosophers, but not necessarily talk to them about philosophy, because I found actually thinking about real kind of hard work pretty challenging in the early pandemic. My mind was in a real daze, but I just wanted to chat to them about philosophy and their lives and how it mattered to them. So I started a podcast, and it is true that it really confirmed something that I think both philosophy and social science also suggest, which is a very deep part of loneliness is just the lack of recognition or acknowledgement. So even just spending half an hour really paying attention to someone else, and in fact, even if no friendship comes of it, just talking and listening can reduce one's sense of loneliness and isolation. That there's just connection even in those little moments. And that's something I feel like I really got out of doing the podcast, was just that spending half an hour listening to someone and thinking afterwards, being sort of having that conversation and connection transform my experience of the next few days. And yeah, I really love doing it.
That's so interesting, because that half hour conversation with other philosophers, some you knew, some you didn't, and then, you know, maybe an hour of editing it afterward, that really changed you in a way that you felt differently, and it helped you get through that difficult time.
No, absolutely. I mean, part of it is that, editing has its own meditative quality of just listening. You have
sure
to concentrate
does.
And listen, and you're, you know, focused on one thing, and like it gets you out of your own head in a way. It's like cooking for me is like that too. But no, I think what it suggested to me, and what it confirmed, is the sense that the fundamental problem of loneliness is not connecting with other people. And obviously what we often crave is a deep connection, a kind of deep engagement with other people, a kind of recognition of their value, and to have them recognize our value in a profound and meaningful way. But although that's different in degree from just the recognition of paying attention to someone in a brief moment of interaction, it's not different in kind. It's what it gives you is the same sense that you matter, you count, you're someone in the human world. And I really got that even from these brief interactions. There's a wonderful study in which people were asked to, or sort of requested as part of a psychological study, to go up to a stranger on a train and ask them a personal question, mm-hmm. and tell them something personal about themselves. And obviously people were a little bit awkward about doing it, but they were almost never rebuffed. And even though it was a one-off encounter, that was already enough to give people a sense of social enlivenment. And I think there's real truth in that. So ultimately, I hope that those little moments of connection for people can be paths to more sustained friendships, but it's amazing how much they can do in themselves, and how much compassion and respect for other people, concern for others, is a kind of path out of one's own sense of loneliness.
Loneliness, though, can be so physically damaging. I mean, the studies just show it can age someone and it can really have problems for different organs of the body, the heart. What is your philosophical thinking on loneliness and how to stop it?
Well, so I think from the point of view of public health, it's a real crisis. And obviously, during the pandemic, it went from being a kind of, there were concerns that loneliness was more prevalent. And but when I was early writing the book, I was not sure about the data. Then the pandemic hit and it was clear that there really was this pervasive problem. And yeah, the health effects are like those of a stress reaction. So it kind of damages your heart health and it causes inflammation. But I mean, one thing to say is those health effects really matter, but in a way they're sort of side effects. The real issue of loneliness is missing other people, lack of connection. I mean, if someone said, here's a pill you can take that will neutralize the health effects of loneliness, probably if you're like me, you think, well, okay, I still would like to connect with other people. And I think what both the social science and the philosophy suggest is that the way out of this is to value other people and to attend and focus on them rather than on the potential friendship or what you're going to get out of it. There's a certain kind of recognition of the value of others that is part of love, really, but also any kind of respect or compassion that is a kind of pathway out of loneliness. And so a lot of the social science suggests that really these small interactions, just saying hi to someone when you're in line at the grocery store or joining a club and forcing yourself to interact, even though those things are difficult, small connections will both already be consoling in themselves. But insofar as you're not worried about the friendship, but you're just focused on someone else, that's the path towards real connection with other people.
Kiran Setia with us, author of Life is Hard. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Along the lines of loneliness, you do make the point that really listening is hard work. I know I said amen to that because I do a lot of listening in my professional life, in my job. How is learning how to really listen well, what impact does that have on relationships?
Well, again, there's a lot of evidence that both in terms of forming new relationships and in transforming one's own current relationships, going through even scripted conversation can be very, very powerful. So one thing I loved about recording the podcast was I get nervous in social situations. I'm not great at small talk. I love the fact that in the podcast, I have it's called Five Questions. I have five questions. And if there's an awkward silence, I can always just say, well, let me ask you question three. And it seems kind of artificial, but actually, having a kind of structured set of questions that are kind of surprising and interesting and going through that with someone you know or don't know can be a kind of transformative shift in a relationship. So it can both form new relationships and get you out of ruts or refresh old ones. So that, you know, you can find, if you actually just go online and look, you'll be able to find, it's easy to find these sort of lists of questions like that. There was one in the New York Times a few years ago that went viral of, and it was like the 26 questions that will make someone fall in love with you. And I think it's not really about someone falling in love with you. It's about, you know, giving some scaffolding to what can be very difficult interactions. Because when you're lonely, there's a kind of catch-22 phenomenon in which the loneliness makes you afraid of social interaction and worried that no one likes you. And then it's harder to interact and harder to get started. And finding this kind of scaffolding can really help you get through that. It, you know, there's the awkwardness of doing something a little artificial, but the truth is it really works. And as I said, it's exactly what is sort of suggested by a philosophical vision on which really the value of friendship is coming from the value of other people. It's the very same value that we recognize when we feel compassion or respect. It's just a more intense, intimate response to it. And really, that's why I think really paying attention to other people is so crucial to love and friendship, and also why it's so affirming to us. It's not about being, you know, being really great or admirable in some way. It's the sense that you just matter in a way. It's kind of the opposite of that. You matter regardless of any of your faults. You don't have to earn it. Everyone is worthy of it. And that kind of affirmation that you can give to other people, even in these structured ways, and receive yourself, I think is that it's that affirmation that is the key to overcoming loneliness and really making human connection.
When that scaffolding falls down, though, when someone dies or goes away or the relationship ends, I can now see how grief can really, really collide with loneliness. The new book is called Life is Hard, and Massachusetts Institute of Technology philosophy professor Kiran Setia stays with us on how philosophy can bring clarity to some worldly problems, life's hardships. Join in along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore life's hardships through a philosophical lens and what it means to live well. MIT philosopher Kiran Setia is our guide, and he writes in his new book, part of living well is living as we should, feeling what there is reason to feel and doing what there is reason to do. Join in, 800-642-1234. The book is called Life is Hard, and Kiran Setia stays with us. Let's go to Mark in Madison. Mark, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I also was lucky enough to spend some time at MIT, not in philosophy, though. This morning, I'd like to hear our professor talk about the comparison between communal cultures and individualistic cultures. Certainly Northern Europe and then the U.S., I would say, is hyper-individualistic, and I think we pay a dear price for that, for our wealth, which separates us. I believe a number of studies have shown that in other countries with much less economic resources have happier people. They have strong social ties. They help one another. We could argue that the very survival of our race has been based on the social nature of what we are and our intense ability to feel pleasure when we cooperate and help others.
Mark, thank you so much for that. Kiran, go ahead.
Well, I certainly agree that we're social animals and that we have this deep need to connect with other people, and that that's a very important part of human flourishing, and that there's a real risk of neglecting it. You know, one of the things I researched when I was writing the book was that the history of this idea that there's an epidemic of loneliness in individualist societies like the U.S. And the history turns out to be very complicated because, if you go back to sort of before the Industrial Revolution, friendships were very utilitarian. People were in a state of economic need where most of their interactions were dictated by that. And the idea of friendship for pleasure was actually something that came out of the work of people, or the sort of shifts that people like Adam Smith, who were a sort of student of industrial capitalism, were studying. So I think the history is complicated, but it does, I think, point to one thing that seems completely on target, which is the more we think of ourselves as individuals whose worth is to be judged by a kind of private accomplishment, paradigmatically the achievement of wealth, and let that be a standard for whether we're living well or badly, whether we're a success or a failure, that aspect of the way in which our society is structured is, I think, very damaging. And it's very important to see that it doesn't have to be like that. That doesn't have to be how we evaluate the worth of individual human beings.
Mark, thank you for the call. Jean now in Washburn. Jean, hi. What's coming up for you?
I'm just wondering if the professor has ever had the opportunity to discuss the estrangement of adult children with their parents, from their parents, and then the grandchildren are not allowed to see their grandparents. And that creates a whole different type of loneliness, which, of course, affects, the health of the elders and the whole family dynamics.
Jean, thank you. Kieran, what about that connection that's lost?
I mean, I don't know if Jean is talking about her own experience. It sounds like a very difficult thing. And I don't have a kind of quick solution to those kinds of very difficult family situations. I mean, one thing to say is that we often think about loneliness in terms of the need for friends, but that's too narrow. I mean, lots of relationships other than friendship are very central to our nature as social animals. If you think of us as social animals, the first environment we're in, social environment, is that of the family. And those kinds of connections are very important to our sense of well-being. So I think I just want to reflect that, yeah, I think it makes perfect sense that those kinds of frayed connections can be very painful and very difficult. And it can be very hard and frightening to try to rebuild connections. And, you know, I really can't give advice because I think it's so personal. It really depends on whether those connections can be rebuilt or whether it's a matter of coming to terms with the fact that they can't be. And that really sort of depends on the circumstances someone finds himself in. But I do think that's a very difficult kind of situation.
What about the elements of grief there and this idea that there's so much love and yet something is gone, whether it's the relationship, whether it's death? What is your philosophical approach there?
I think that's a great reframing and a great question. I mean, I think that's right. We often, when we think about grief, focus on the central case in which someone dies, and that is a central grief phenomenon. But part of that phenomenon is a kind of shift in the relationship. And there's also the kind of grief that attends the end or rupture in a relationship, which doesn't involve someone's death. It could be the grief of a breakup with a life partner or a separation from a family member. And often the way people, I think, get through those kinds of moments is by thinking about the relationship as not really having ended, but having changed, that there's still a way in which you relate to people who were part of your life that's very different from the way you relate to anyone else. And that you have to think, well, okay, what kinds of relationships might now be available that would be meaningful kinds of relationships? So it might just be, you know, following what's happening with that person and in one's own thoughts, keeping touch with them, even if you can't reconnect with them. And, you know, those kinds of connections, sort of thinking about someone in a way that restores your own emotional connection to them, are part of how people adapt to the grief of loss when someone dies. And they can be part of how people cope with the grief of a ruptured relationship too.
There has been so much death in COVID, and you reflected on, we're not even sure what to do when someone dies. How has that been ruptured for you and for other people?
Well, yeah, so that I think there is this sort of puzzle about grief, which is that if what you're grieving is the loss of someone and they're gone, that fact sort of never goes away. In a mm-hmm. sense, you could grieve forever. Why would you ever stop? And I think what helps us through those kinds of transitions is not some kind of rational solution that tells you, here's the correct amount of time to grieve. It's, you know, 3 years or whatever, or 3 months, or it's the kind of social structures and conventions of mourning. And so, you know, for me, my father-in-law died during the pandemic, not of COVID, but of what seemed to be a heart attack. And he died far away, and my wife couldn't be there, and it felt unreal, and we couldn't have a funeral. And the whole thing was just the conventions that normally give you a sense of how to map your way through those initial stages were broken. And I think that's true for a lot of people during the pandemic. And it's true, I think, more generally, that our kind of firm attachment to conventions for how to mourn and knowing how to do it is less secure than it might have been a few generations ago. I think what you have to do in those circumstances is, in a way, to improvise. So, you know, one thing that my wife did was we watched college basketball because he loved college basketball. Hmm. We bought a lottery ticket because he loved gambling. I mean, he turned it into his new line was cryptocurrency, but basically gambling. And one thing we had a kind of memorial online in which a lot of his friends who might not have been able to be there in person could talk about their memories of him. And one thing, we'd always known that he really was great at friendship, that he really maintained these connections. But the memorial, the Zoom memorial, really brought that home. And one way in which I think that's changed my wife's own life is that in the aftermath, she thought, I'm going to reconnect with friends from college and high school and grad school, people I love and miss, and try to maintain a regular connection with them. And what's happening there is sort of trying to think about how to honor someone's life in your own life when you don't have the standard conventional sort of trappings of a funeral. And that's something people can kind of creatively try to think through for themselves.
Kiran Satya with us, professor of philosophy at MIT, talking about how philosophy can help us through life's hard times. New book is Life is Hard. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Heard from Tony in Madison, called in and couldn't stay with us. And Tony says there's that old phrase, Kiran, simple mind, simple pleasures. And that phrase and the people who live it, Tony says, encompass the mindset you're discussing, and says people need to just enjoy life instead of worrying about, wearing the right thing or having the right stuff in their life. What would you say to that?
I kind of love this point because it's sort of absurd for a philosopher who's professional life involves overthinking everything to say that I kind of agree that there are real risks to overthinking things, and that you know, often the effect of sort of stepping back from your life to evaluate whether it's good or bad is to abstract from the actual concrete connections with the good things in your life and the people you're attached to, and start asking questions like, well, could I have had a better relationship or a better job, when you might well find that there are good things about your job and about your relationship that you can affirm, and that you don't need to make this move of sort of artificially detaching yourself from that. So I think there's real insight in what Tony's saying.
We have philosopher Kiran Satya takes us through the paces, what it means to be alive and face hardships. And he's weaving together insights from philosophical thinkers through the ages who've explored the human condition. We're going to look at hope next. Still time to talk about philosophy in difficult times, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the pleasure of being in conversation with MIT philosophy professor Kiran Satya, and his new book is this kind of roadmap to help navigate the absurdity of life, the difficult times, to explore how philosophy can speak more personally to what we feel along the way. Still time to talk about philosophy and life, 800-642-1234. Kiran Satya stays with us. So let's look more closely at hope, because we think about perhaps hope is something inspirational and good, but you include hope as one of life's hardships. What is painful or problematic about hope?
Well, it's true that I have always been myself ambivalent about hope, partly because I feel like there's a kind of naivety to hope, and that sometimes you just have to face the facts that something you wish were true just really is not going to happen. And also because I think hope can so easily be passive and quiescent, and you can sort of, you know, you can sit there on the couch hoping, looking at the news, hoping everything turns out okay without doing anything about it. So although hope may be, you know, necessary or part of what is the background to action, by itself, it really isn't worth much. So I think that's the case against hope. Like, as I said, I'm ambivalent about it, and I'm partly ambivalent about it because I think there's really two things to talk about here. One is just the state of mind where you hope for something, and sometimes that's reasonable, sometimes not. By itself, it, you know, may not do any good. The other is what you might think of as the virtue of hope. This distinction goes back to the medieval theologian Aquinas, who distinguishes the irascible passion of hope from the virtue, which he thinks of as theological. It's connected with your relationship to God. But you can have a secular version of the virtue of hope, on which the virtue is about hoping for the right things in the right times, in the right way, sort of figuring out what to hope for. And I think that shift in perspective is really helpful to me, to stop really asking the question, should we hope or not? Is hope good or bad? And to realize that we're always going to hope, the question is never, is it good or bad? It's always, well, what should we hope for? So, you know, I think about climate change as one of the things where it's so easy to feel despair, and it's certainly sort of a burden that I feel when I look at the future. Should we hope or should we despair? And I think, well, that's a bad question. The question is what to hope for. When we can't hope for, you know, 1.5 degrees of warming, well, let's hope for 1.6, or let's hope for 1.7. And then never to forget that merely hoping is not enough. Once you've figured out what to hope for, the question now is, what can you do about it? And, mm-hmm. you know, we can't, no individual can do everything, but we often find ourselves with groups or collectives that we can participate in where we can make some kind of difference.
Right, because it's the action, as you say, not the hope, that is really at the root of this. What, you know, you have to act here as part of hope. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. The thought is, you know, figuring out what to hope for is a first step, and hoping for the right things. But we should never think of hope as the end point. Hope is a precondition for action. It's not in itself what matters. And in fact, hope itself can be very painful and distressing. If you hope for things, you're risking disappointment. It's really not about the hope. It's about like where you can direct your agency, where you can act. And there, I think, you know, it's easy to feel overwhelmed about when you're looking at the news at how much terrible stuff is coming. But while no one of us can do everything, what we can often do when we think of what to hope for is maybe local change, or to connect with other people in our own networks who also care about what it is we care about. And those kinds of connections are ones in which we can make a difference on a smaller scale. And also, I think, feel like we're making a difference, because, you know, one of the challenges of, say, caring about something like climate change is again, isolation. If you're worried about it on your own, it's very easy to get down. Doing something with other people relieves anxiety. It's both more positive response in that it's more likely to make a difference, and it's a more positive response and it's likely to make you feel a sense of empowerment and reduce the anxiety that otherwise afflicts us.
Can you, give that personal example of you just bringing food to student protesters at MIT?
Right. Yeah. So this was a case where I'm not a kind of activist leader. You know, it's not something I would naturally do. But when I arrived at MIT, this is in 2014, the student group Fossil Free MIT had been pressuring the administration to divest from fossil fuels and set up a climate action plan. And MIT set up a climate action plan, but didn't divest. And it was disappointing. The students started a sit-in. And I was one of the faculty who wrote a letter protesting the Institute's decision, and then supported the students and sat with them in the hallways and brought them food. And eventually they got concessions from MIT. And that was, for me, a real paradigm of this, because I couldn't have done it on my own. But once there was a group telling me, here's what we need to do, I thought, okay, I can join a group. And because it was action on a local scale, it was a case where I thought, well, it only took a few, probably less than 200 students really caring about something to make a difference at MIT. And MIT, you know, it's not, you know, the US government, but it's making a difference there is really making a difference. It's something much bigger than yourself. And when MIT makes, you know, new climate policies, other institutions notice. So seeing those pathways where you in your small way can connect with something a little bit larger that can connect with something a little bit larger really gave me a sense of empowerment that I was actually doing something. And, you know, since then I started teaching a class on the ethics of climate change at MIT, and I've been writing and talking about the issue much more. And so I feel like that moment of connecting with the student group really made me feel like I was not alone and that we could actually do something.
Right, because problems like climate change or racism or poverty, or as you started at the top, the war on misinformation, can feel really beyond our ability, beyond our scope for one person to affect change. So how do philosophers grapple with a world in which so much suffering and injustice exists?
Well, part of it is, I think, sort of remembering that it's a mistake to say, you know, it won't make any difference what I do, you know, because so many people will still suffer. Because, you know, if you save one person out of two, the difference you make is the same as when you save one person out of 2 million. Or if you add your little fraction to the odds of change by engaging in a protest, it's just a fraction. But that's something. You're making a small difference. So we have to remember that small differences are differences, even if that's what we're going to achieve. But the other thing I find, this is very much in the spirit of my book, sort of paradoxically comforting, is the sense that we are going to feel like we're falling short, and we never know if we've done enough. But that's not a sign of some kind of special deficiency on our part. That's a condition of living in times of injustice. And it's not specific to people like me who are not really activists. Talking to people who are, spend their lives being activists, one of the first things they will tell you, one of the first things they tell me, is they also worry that they're not doing enough. This sense that you could always be doing more is just part of the condition of living in circumstances when there's so much to be done and one never knows if one has sort of hit the mark of, like, this is the most I can ask of myself. And I think we just have to be forgiving about that. We have to accept that we're going to feel like maybe we should do more, but that everyone feels that way. And we shouldn't, that kind of self-lacerating thought is not helping anyone. It's doing little things that helps, and they slowly add up.
We're going to land here on religion. Kay from Grand Chute called and couldn't stick around, but Kay believes in God and thinks a creator understands people's pain in an unfair life. And Kay says religion and faith is a way for people to find peace. What role does religion have in these hardships?
I think that's absolutely right. And I'm not religious myself, so a lot of what my approach to these questions, it involves asking what kinds of consolation, which of the consolations of religion can we find space for if we're not religious? So I think there is this consolation that God knows our suffering. Well, if we can't have that because we don't believe in God, we can share it. We can talk to other people. We can have the consolation of solidarity with other human beings. Not that religious people don't also want that. And similarly, when we're fighting injustice, we might have a kind of assurance, if we believe in God, that things are going to turn out a certain way. We have a basis for hope that we might not have if we're non-religious. But still, that idea that the kind of shape of human history, the trajectory towards a greater justice, is something we can aspire to. And that if we aspire to it, that will change how we can feel about the whole of human existence, not just our own, about human history and what kind of shape it has taken. Those kinds of thoughts, I think, are available to people who are not religious. There's a way in which, you know, the idea of the meaning of life can be given a secular sense. It has to do with how we should feel about human history. And that really depends, if there's no God, it really depends on us and what we collectively do to shape human life and human history, or the human future on this planet.
Kieran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Kieran Setia is a philosophy professor at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His new book is called Life is Hard: How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.